There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
He hit Austin.
My name is Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Hello again, fans worldwide. This is your old friend Phil Pritchett here. It's time for the P2 broadcast, our weekly broadcast from Trinidad World Recording, my recording studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. I'm joined by my good friend Kurt South, fellow singer-songwriter here in Fort Worth. Hello, Curtis.
Greetings. How are you?
Today on the show, we're going to get into some great talk here, some pertinent issues that we discuss in the van, in the studio, and elsewhere. Right off the top, though, we're gonna get into some discussions of recent Texas music / Fort Worth music bar history. And backdropped against that, a backdrop of how me and Kurt kind of got playing, and most of all, kind of how we got to know each other here in the last several years. Coming up in our next segment, we're going to take a look at the new Phil Pritchett and the Full Band record that is being recorded, worked on, and why it's really unlike any record we've done before in its formation. In our final segment, we're going to talk about the stuff we listen to, me and Kurt, records that sound great on any speakers, whatever you're listening to, the records you go back. When I'm sitting here mixing stuff for bands, I'm producing my own stuff, there are those albums you go back and listen to repeatedly, you know, and just you're listening to that kick drum, the snare, the bass, the level, the vocal, the fuzz on the guitar, that case, like, gosh, they just got it so right there. And as we'll discuss in our segment, oftentimes it shows a common thread, usually a great old Neve console or a producer, a good set of ears,
RCA
driving the bus.
And Neves.
That's right. But we're going to start out here, bring some of our listeners here up to speed on how this all got started. How we're in here today. Let me tell you, I moved to Nashville after, on our last show, we talked about Phil World, the first record. I made a couple other records, moved to Nashville with the family, tried to get some songwriting stuff done. Didn't do too good, excuse me. Tried to get some songwriting stuff done. I wrote a lot of songs, some songs we ended up doing with the band, but moved back to Fort Worth, and I'm from Dallas originally, but my wife, born and raised here in Fort Worth. Great place to have a house and raise a family and all that kind of good stuff. Well, I needed to play a little bit, you know, work some stuff out and get a little cash. Taught some substitute teaching. Boy, man, you want to talk about a rough gig, the substitute teacher.
That's got to be worse than the worst gig you've ever played. It's gotta
man,
be.
Yeah. I mean, you know what?
Be.
I mean, knowing as my wife's a teacher, it was a humbling deal, man, to go. You're there at 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning, and you're there till 5 o'clock, really. I mean, when you're really taking the drive and
right,
all that.
Right, right.
And, man, you're just babysitting, I was doing like 6th, 7th grade. 2 full days I was out at this school, which shall remain nameless, but it was a perfectly nice school. But, man, exhausting. Hours, man. I mean, 20 hours of my life devoted to this. And they send me a check, you know, like 3 months later. For, like, you know, they took out for withholding, you know, teachers' union dues, you know, everything, you know, insurance, they take out all this stuff. So it ended up, like, each day ended up being worth, like, $51. You know, so I got $102 or something. I'm just kind of like, it was actually like $89. And I remember thinking, good grief. I started thinking back to these gigs I was turning down. You know, right. I was trying to work, you know, it's like, man, you know, there's some gigs out there that'll pay me, you know, $150 to sit there and play a few songs on
how hard
the stool.
It be?
You know, I'm just kind of like, man, maybe I ought to call some of those. So that's kind of what I did. I went over to the Moon right there across from TCU. I started playing in the Moon. Nobody there. I mean, I'd lost my place in line, so to speak, really. So, I was, you know, playing the new songs and all that kind of good stuff every Monday night, or was it Tuesday night?
It was Tuesday nights. Because I was playing every Monday night at the White Elephant at this time.
I think that's right. So I was rolling in there with the guitar, and man, a lot of nights there wasn't anybody in there. So if it got real slow, I'd get bored and just start kind of jacking around. Well, lo and behold, there's this guy in there with a ball cap just falling off his stool. The man, he knows every word to my most obscure song. I'm playing like deep cuts off of Heritage Way, you know, I'm playing Nowhere and Summertime, and you know, this guy's out there playing Stumbling Free, man. Just
life blah, of Paul.
Just running into the bathroom every 5 minutes.
You talking about me or McCoskey? Which one are you describing?
There's this table of guys that just creep me out, you know, and on it went. So I find out, of course, they're all musicians. You know, that was always the bane of my career, and to some degree,
your fans are.
Yeah, there's a man. Your fans are a lot of musicians.
Yeah, you know?
But in my experience, I've learned that the bands with their fans are a bunch of drunk, good-looking girls. Those guys do a lot better.
Yeah,
wouldn't you say? Dollar wise,
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you get 500 drunk girls there, the guys will follow, and then you got 1,000. You got 3,000 people.
If you want to see 50 other guitar players and drummers, come to one of my shows.
Yeah. In front of house, engineers going. Sounds kind of thin in the back, man. I don't know.
And the reason those guys are there is because they're all hoping I'll give them a gig playing in the band.
That's right.
At some point, they're just trying to make money and further their own career.
That's right. Yeah. As you were at my gig, you're there. Yeah. You're there for your own interest. You know, you get some free beer.
I was there because it was $2. You call it, I think.
$2. You call it. No cover. So I'm made aware of none other than Kurt South, and I'm like, okay. So I see an opportunity just to say. If I'd play an hour, I'd just go, all right, you get up here and play. Yeah, you want to do a song? You're like, yeah, yeah. So Kurt started getting up and sort of sharing the shows. Of course, our buddy Jordan McCoskey was there, too, in those days. Good old Jordan. And so we started rotating in there. And, you know, your little orbit of guys would kind of start coming to the moon.
Yeah.
McCoskey's orbit of guys. And lo and behold, we kind of had a good thing going there on Tuesday nights for a while, you know, at the moon.
Yeah.
And it was a fun thing.
It was. And, it was a fun thing. We were in danger of having it crowded some nights.
I know. Very, very disturbing when a lot of people would show up. You know, it'd be really packed with a bunch of folks in there, and we'd have to, you know, behave ourselves and play some good songs.
Not throw up on the mics or anything.
Some of y'all might have seen some confusing stuff on the internet about the Rat Pack, and that's really where that became involved. Very unoriginal name, really.
Yeah.
For three, you know, guys just drinking some beers, playing some songs. We're like, man, let's come out the Fort Worth Rat Pack. You know, so whatever. McCoskey got some posters made at his dad's office or something. You know, like, they weren't posters, they were like murals, really. They were like
and they were
six feet by 4 feet or something.
Yeah, they were huge.
Of the three of us walking down the street in the stockyards with
just
our sunglasses
wearing
on.
Suits.
Wearing our suits. Yeah, it was supposed to be a higher caliber type show. We wore jackets. We played all our own songs, but then, you know, slowly I learned all y'all songs and y'all's mine, and it became a three-man kind of show. But some fun days there, man, the early in the moon. We get what's the guy's name from Flickerstick?
Brandon Lee and John Price would come in. And,
John Price was there a lot, yeah.
Yeah, and then, it kind of became a focal point for the local scene in some small way.
Not widely reported in the local press, though, I don't think.
Is there local press?
I don't know. Man,
I didn't think there was press in Fort Worth.
I don't know.
if there is, we're not aware of them.
We weren't. We certainly weren't being covered with this emerging thing we had going on. We also had our good friend Matt Lansford was always there.
Lansford was
hardworking,
there.
Hardworking waiter at Joe T. Garcia's here in Fort Worth.
Mikey Wynn was also there.
Mikey Wynn.
Who is now an esteemed guitar builder in Fort Worth.
That's right.
Yeah.
Mikey Wynn. So that was us, man. Lansford, Wynn. McCoskey, Mean South.
You remember the only coverage that show did get was when a reporter from some small publication walked in, and Mikey Wynn happened to be on stage with his jeans tucked in his work boots, wearing his A&M ball cap, singing Copperhead Road, playing an Epiphone mandolin with a stick-on pickup on it.
Oh, didn't it say like he was showing a depth of soul not seen in Fort Worth?
Yeah, it was something just. Just so hilarious and ironic that...
Like, I went to this Pritchett show, but he went on stage. But, man, I was treated to a gift I had not beheld in some 10 years in this business. This writer mind was opened up. Yeah, Mikey did it playing, like, the Long Black Veil. And
yeah.
What was the other one he played all the time?
Copperhead Road and Long Black Veil.
What was the other one, though? Well, I am a... Not Moonshiner. Dust Bowl. No, I'm trying to think of.
Oh, what does Bull Western Kansas? Yeah, it's a.
Song is that? What's the chorus of that? I'm drawing a blank. Dust Bowl, Western Kansas.
I can't remember.
Now, email it, phil@philpritchard.com. Tell us what song it is.
Classic song. Classic song.
Classic song. So that's how it started, man. Phil back in Fort Worth. Gosh, we had our third baby on the way. Oh, my goodness gracious. Those were some tough times for me, man. Getting up there at the moon. And
you were surrounded by a bunch of drunken buffoon hacks. Oh, my God. Just trying to make ends meet, and we were standing in your way.
Yep, that's right. But lo and behold, we kind of got a little act going out of it. And then we ended up moving the Rat Pack show to the White Elephant. Of course, did the Mondays at White Elephant for about a year, I guess.
Yeah, it went on for a while.
And there was a lot of discussion about some projects that never came to pass. If you go to YouTube, you can see All the Time in the World.
Yeah.
Me and Jordan McCoskey, Kurt South, playing All the Time in the World in the old Trinidad World Recording studio.
Still a very popular video, man. People like that.
Yeah.
That's a good
scene.
Good,
a lot, man. A lot of people check video. That out.
Yeah.
It came out sounding really good. I just put a mic in front of each of us. What you're hearing on the track there is actually the recording. It's not like a... I mean, it's like an actual mix of the song, you know, that I did on my little unit I had back then, you know, my little recording machine. And it came out pretty good, man. So some good music, and what was on the set list of the Rat Pack? Your typical Rat Pack show.
Oh, well,
of course, we had our originals, but what were some
man,
of the?
Man, always my Sweet Carolina by Ryan Adams always found its way in. Willin was always a big focal point of the
course,
show.
Of course, of course. I did the Petty song.
Have Love Will Travel.
A rare, underappreciated last DJ song. Not a fan of the record myself. Not great a big fan of it, I should say. It's pretty good.
It's a little preachy.
It's a little preachy. A little.
You would always petty whip on. Out. You would always whip out an obscure Police song, or you would play.
80s Phil would rear his head.
You would do a
Message
really nice
a
version of Nick Lowe's "What's So Funny About Peace, Love, and Understanding."
Right. That's of course my Elvis Costello influence there shining through. Petty.
Train to Birmingham by John Hyatt. Was
well, Kurt can play any. I've never seen anybody play more cover songs flawlessly than Kurt South. You never seem to get stumped on a lyric. I'll miss the same lyric, but I'll just mutter it. You know, I'll just sort of plow through it. Hope nobody notices. But
I've absorbed a lot of music in my time.
That's right.
A lot of music.
Go over some other ones. The Jackie Green song McCoskey did. Was that
Gone Wandered by Jackie Green. Always made an appearance.
Jackie, that's a really good song.
That's a great
song.
I never
heard any more from that guy.
Oh, yeah, he's...
See, I see his name, but then...
You know what he's doing right now? He's he plays guitar with Phil Lesh and friends.
What, really?
Yeah.
The Grateful Dead guy?
Yeah. Bass player from the Grateful Dead who has his, you know, it's his own project now.
Right.
But Jackie Green put out a really critically acclaimed record last year called Giving Up the Ghost.
Yeah.
That was on everybody's top 10.
Isn't that
list.
McGee Payne's record?
Yeah, that Payne was so angry that Jackie Green stole that from him. He just called me up one day and goes, guess what the name of the new Jackie Green album is? I'm like,
Giving Up the
I
Ghost.
Don't know.
Yeah,
Giving
title.
Up the Ghost. It was mine.
It was my title. What happened?
Well,
you know, speaking of the Grateful Dead, man, did I ever tell you the story about Doug Holm going to the wedding where Bob Weir was the minister?
This is such a great story.
Should I do this here?
Yes.
Podcast, we do this in the next segment.
Do it.
We'll do it right here. I'll keep it reasonably brief. My bass player from when I lived in Austin, the Austin band, quote unquote, that we did Suburban Legends with was Keith Robinson. Great drummer. A few years older than me, experienced. He played with Charlie Robinson for years after he played with me. And then Marsha Ball, a bunch of people like that. Great player. And then, of course, Doug Holm on bass. He, great guy. And, so recently, a few years after we, you know, I'd moved to Fort Worth and stuff, Doug Holm was in a, he was going to be in a wedding. It was in San Francisco or somewhere. Isn't that where Weir lives?
Yeah, yeah.
So lo and behold, Doug tells me, he goes, hey, man, Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead is the the minister. He's some sort of a man of the cloth of some kind, a deacon of sorts. I don't know. Is that what that is? Some like
he's,
church.
He's an ordained minister. He's an ordained minister of some description. Yeah.
Church of the Redwood Tree or something like that.
Something,
or, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
So Weir is like he's performing the ceremony, but then he's also related to like the groom or something. Anyway, so Doug is in this wedding. And so I said, well, let me tell me how it goes. And man, he calls me back. And the best little segment was for the rehearsal. They're just like, gosh, where's the minister? Where's Bob? Where's Bob? And they're looking around for Bob Weir. And all of a sudden, there's this tire screeching. It's like this gigantic, like, silver Mercedes. Just comes up, just like, just kind of up on the curb, you know. Just the door opens up, and just he just kind of leaves the engine running, door open, and it's Weir. And just barefoot, just kind of gets out, and just kind of comes, just shuffling into the church. Like the headlights are on, the radio's on, the door's open. He just kind of comes walking in, just kind of nods, and you know, stand, tells everybody where to stand or whatever. But then a little later, they go to the rehearsal dinner, and Weir is I don't know if this would be that funny without hearing Doug tell it, but he tells it great. But Doug's cheerful and beautiful, great wife, Jenny, used to sell our merch at Fitzwillie's and sold Phil Pritchett merch. Boy, could she sell it. All cute girl out there. Oh, my goodness gracious. The numbers would be big when Jenny sold the merch. So Jenny, she had eaten a piece of chocolate cake at the rehearsal dinner. So she says, Doug, you want to bite? And Doug takes a bite of the cake, says, it's real good. And Weir's next to Jenny, and he's in the middle of some story telling about, like, I was surfing off the coast of Big Sur, you know, and a whale surfaced next to me and looked me right in the eye, and we locked, you know, our beings were matched, whatever. And so Jenny says, Bob, you want a bite of this cake? And he's like, he just kind of haphazardly, just out of the corner of his eye, he kind of picks up the cake, and while he's still telling the story, he takes a bite of the cake. You know, he's just chewing while he's still telling the story. Oh, yeah, anyway, the whale. And just his hands just move over to Jenny's, grab the cake, and just pull it to his face. And, dude, he just sits there and just, while he's still telling the story about the whale, Jenny's still sitting there, like, with the fork. And he just sits there and just shoves this whole cake in his mouth, like, with his bare hands. Just like, anyway, this whale, he eats the whole thing, and then just kind of throws the plate down. Clink, you know, and everyone at the table is just looking, and, you know, Weir just continues to talk with just cake on his chin, and he just never says, like, thanks, or, oh, I'm sorry, was that your cake, or nothing. And, you know, Doug was just, he goes, man, it was the funniest thing I ever saw. He just ate the look on my wife's face of Weir just grabbing her cake and eating it. And then we started talking about that whole deal, and those rock stars like that. I mean, Weir, how old was he when he got in the Grateful Dead? You know,
19?
Something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, those guys, can you imagine? They never had to walk into a room their whole life. Whole adult life, anyway.
Right.
And say, oh, I'm sorry, is this our dressing room? Or, you know, is this beer for us? Oh, dude, I'm sorry. Or, oh, man, I ate off this deli tray. I hope that's okay. I mean, they just walk in. They know that everything in there is for them. I mean, just everything. They never have to ask, you know. I mean, they just grab whatever they want. Oh, this is good. Just eats it, you know. Just, I mean, he doesn't ask permission. I love that image, though, man, of just Weir talking about the whale, eating the cake, and just the aghast look on Jenny Holmes' face. Very priceless.
I have
stuff.
A similar story.
What's that?
That has to do
eating
with
cake?
It has to do with backstage catering. Mm. And it involves everyone's favorite red
cater. Dirt. You get catering? Because we don't get anything.
Listen. All right. It involves Cross Canadian Ragweed.
Uh-huh.
And Jordan.
Our good friends, Cross Canadian.
Great people. Jordan McCoskey was playing a gig, a fraternity function of some description, and it was at the Coliseum on the campus at SMU.
Oh, okay. The Dallas show.
Ragweed was the headliner.
Yeah.
And, I mean, this is in an arena, huge stage. I mean, big arena.
Also in the
show.
Basketball arena there.
Yeah.
What's it called?
I can't remember what it's called.
Yeah, I know. Basketball.
I mean, it's in the arena. Ragweed's playing. And Greg Schrader and I had played a gig with Jordan.
Moody Coliseum.
Yeah, Moody Coliseum. That's right. Yeah. Greg Schrader and I had tagged along as roadies.
The great Greg Schrader.
The great Greg Schrader. We had played a gig with Jordan the night before in College Station. We tag along to this arena show that he's doing, opening up for Ragweed.
So this is some kind of a campus event sort of deal.
Yes, it is. It's a big
it's
campus
It's a private
event.
Show. It's not
right,
a, it's not, okay,
right.
Right, right.
So McCoskey had booked the show through Blue, your bass player.
Yes.
Now,
the great J.W. Marshall.
Great J.W. Marshall. He had the connection with whoever was putting the show on. And part of Jordan's contract rider included all this church's fried chicken, all these chicken strips and biscuits.
Is this something you put on there as a joke or something?
No. I mean, he said, you know, Y'all like need to provide food, chicken. And I want Church's fried chicken. And they oblige us. So we get to the show before Ragweed does.
Oh, gosh.
Set up, do sound check.
Yeah.
This nice girl takes us backstage and goes, this is your catering. Y'all have unlimited chicken fingers and biscuits back here. You know, it's like four boxes of this stuff. So Ragweed shows up after Jordan sound checks, and they do their sound check. And we walk backstage after their sound check just to see them neck deep in our church's chicken.
Oh, much to McCoskey's chagrin.
Well, the thing, and they're all such nice guys.
Sure.
And they had no idea that it wasn't for them. Nobody told them.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember the drummer, Randy Ragsdale, was just sitting there just eating chicken and biscuits. And he looks at me and goes, hey, guys, y'all want some of our chicken? And we're just standing there going, yeah, well, if you can spare just a piece or something, that'd be great. And McCoskey's like, well, do we say anything? And we're like, no, nah, just let it go. They mean no ill will by it.
No, mean no ill will.
They didn't know. Yeah. They're such nice guys. You hate to ruin their enjoyable chicken dinner anyway.
That's right, man. They're not accustomed to walking back there and saying, is this for us?
Right, exactly.
Oh, this is the opening band's catering?
Right.
Come on, man.
I don't even think they were aware that there was an opening band. They just thought we had stumbled in off the street.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, was that your guitar up there?
Whatever. Oh, hey, man.
But yeah, another funny story like that.
Yeah, the headlining acts, man. I've fallen victim to this.
You've
many,
done that to
many
me
times.
Several times. You've stolen my catering.
You don't realize it till you're in the middle of it. You don't realize you're kind of a spoiled music rock and roll dude till you're called on it or till someone does it to you. You know,
you
kind of go back there, you start eating food. Grab a beer, grab a water, grab some towels, and oh, hey, man, that's not y'all's stuff. She's like, huh, what?
You've kicked me around backstage a few times.
I know it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was good for you, though.
It helped mold me into what I am today.
Well, that's some talk, man, with Phil and Kurt, how we got to know each other. Down memory lane there. Thank you for that journey, Mr. South. We are going
journey.
To get into our next segment here. What's the next segment going to be?
The next segment is going to be... the new Phil Pritchett album.
Yeah, how can I forget? I drew a blank. I was thinking about the vinyl corner coming up here. That's right. Next segment, we're going to get into some Phil Pritchett talk, the full band. What is on tap for 09 as the full band records here at Trinidad? We'll get back into that here shortly. Stick around. Welcome back. Phil Pritchett here, Trinidad World Recording Studios, Fort Worth, Texas. Joining me is my good friend Kurt South, fellow singer-songwriter. We're here in Trinidad. It is March now, 09. The new Phil Pritchett record. Me and the guys have been up here banging around on some tunes and was just going to talk about some of the issues floating around that. On the last show, we talked about the importance or lack of importance of putting out an actual album. And some of the philosophies therein. Kurt is over here. He's did a couple songs here the other day and puts his stuff out a song or two at a time. Mm-hmm. Interesting way to do it. Mm-hmm. I've had several guys come into the studio and do like a 5-song EP.
Right.
With the anticipation of putting out more music more regularly, you know, rather than waiting a year or two to put out like, you know, 12 songs or something like that. All those things have merit. As always, we want to hear your thoughts and comments on this. You can email phil@philpritchett.com. If you have like to chime in on any of these discussions, we'll read it aloud and try to answer it on the next podcast. It happens
on air mail.
On air mail.
Idea. I like
that. Right. Well,
like
we recorded early in the week before we post. So send us any questions or comments or gripes and complaints to phil@philpritchett.com. But back to the Phil Pritchett full band record. It is something I grapple with, and I'll just lay it all out here for everybody. You know, I've made how many records, South? You've owned them all on vinyl. What? How many is that?
11?
11 records.
Is that right?
Well, that includes probably two Blueprint Garage releases, which are kind of outtakes, B-sides.
Yeah.
Although I'd say the first Blueprint Garage could be its own album. It's all original studio-produced stuff. But I digress. Our last record was, of course, The Bullfighter Returns. John Reynolds made the great video for us for the song. A lot of fun. And but it's been out about a year now, and we did that record kind of more as a nod to the records of old. I do think people get bogged down putting 14, 15 songs out on a CD.
Mm-hmm.
Very expensive, time-consuming, and a lot for anyone to take in, I think, even your most ardent fan. I think of the bands I love, I just don't listen to everything they put out. I mean, I'll skip through it, you know, and with very rare exceptions. I'm sitting here thinking, you know, Spoon, Girls Can Tell, you know, that's a record I can listen to every song on.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm trying to think of some other recent stuff, newly released stuff that's in that category.
Very, Ray LaMontagne's Trouble album.
You know, I saw him playing Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
You done with him now?
No.
Okay. All right.
I'm gonna wait to turn my back on.
Your boy Springsteen played the Super Bowl. Now LaMontagne's playing Saturday Night Live.
It's all going
What's next?
It's all going.
John Hyatt on Ellen.
He was on Letterman the other day. He and Lyle Lovett. Lyle Lovett just wearing a suit singing back up to Thing Called Love. It was great.
Are you ready for a thing called love?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's one album, and it's. I can't think of another one off the top of my head that has been put out recently that I could listen to front to back. And
well, you are his most ardent fan.
No, not. Oh. I haven't even heard his last two albums hardly.
Oh, really?
Okay. Not very much. But that was.
But you're on board with the Ray LaMontagne, huh?
Absolutely. That album was incredible. But it's one in a million, man. There's so few albums that come out where just front to back.
Yeah,
and listen to them and not get tired of them. And plus, that album was also a pretty concise album. It wasn't. It was 9, 10 songs. You know, it wasn't 14 songs. No one's got time to listen to that.
It's an interesting point, though. It's something we've revisited here on this show, and we'll continue, no doubt, folks. That you know, radio, the importance of radio goes away a bit. There's no question about. It. And as the album has gone away as well, it's still. I think that's a good thing, like, you know, Spoon or LaMontagne or something you listen to a lot. It's kind of, it still is its own art form, I think. I mean, a band that can put something together and hold people's attention for, you know, 9, 10, 11 songs. So our last record, The Bullfighter, I had 8 songs on there. I got a few dissenting emails on that. But in our defense, you know, we had it up for, you know, $4 on P2 Tunes. And then iTunes, I think it's only $5.99, $6.99. I don't know. But, it was 8 songs, and you know my what I noticed before that record was you do go back and look at old vinyl records. You know, St. Dominic's Preview comes to mind. Van Morrison, there's 7 tracks on it. How many tracks are on? Everybody knows This Is Nowhere.
7.
Yeah. You know, of course, the great Neil Young, Crazy Horse record. 6 or 7 songs, 8 songs. This is what records were back in the day. It really was like the 90s, in the Hootie and the Blowfish. Sell 15 million copies era, the peak where guys were putting, you felt pressure to put, you know, 75 minutes of music on every record.
Yeah.
And I just think a lot of bands, anybody really can't fill it with that. And so, you know, I am a believer in the album in a band like ours that does play a more rootsy classic kind of stuff, you know, and we are going to try to do an album now. We've toyed with putting out a song here and there, but we are working on an album. This has been a weird experience, though, this recent time. I'll just share that with everyone, including you and the fans. But the fact is, I used to write songs on a notebook pad. You know, I'd write my, you know, you probably do the same.
Yeah,
or did do. You know, you got your lyrics and you with the chords written above the lyrics, G, C, you know. And I've got whole notebooks of them, you know, with all my songs, Dishwater Hands and, you know. Skywalker, they're all in the filing cabinet somewhere, you know, probably many incarnations of it. But you did write the lyrics, you know, verse, chorus. Having my own studio now, it's a lot different because I don't come in here with completed lyrical ideas and songs and preconceived notions for what the album's going to be. So on the Bullfighter, you know, we did come in and I just kind of had, I always have music first. I've always got a guitar thing I like, a drum beat, a, you know, some kind of feeling, you know, a band or something that I'm trying to emulate to maybe some degree, you know, or capture something.
Yeah,
maybe
you just
well.
Kind of have a raw outline.
Yeah, there's a raw outline for it. I was like, man, this is just G minor C, and then we're just gonna get funky on the D7, you know, whatever. And that's kind of how they start. And Stu will hit a drum beat, Blue will start playing the bass, and you know, I'm banging on the organ or playing guitar, and then I'll sing a vocal track, just a scratch vocal, just a nonsense, just trying to find the melody, trying to find. Mm-hmm. The vocal range on it. So that's kind of where the record stands right now. But man, we have a staggering number of those. We have maybe 20, 25, 30, you know, stuff, things that we've played, you know, that don't really have lyrics, but I'll ask your opinion on that. South, this is a guy who puts out one or two songs. What do you do with that kind of stuff? Yeah, I've got maybe 30. It's hard for me to get my head around. I go, man, do I go finish? Do I pick the best 8 or do I pick the best 10 or do I finish a couple and put them out? You know, and this isn't that I'm, because I certainly don't have like a writer's block or anything like that.
Right,
or,
right.
But I tell you what, it is weird in today's world. You're like, you know, I want to keep the fans happy. I want to share my music. I want to have a chance to have an impact like anybody who makes music, you know.
Right, so right.
But there's a lot of ways to go with that. Do you put out the double album with a 2 15 song discs, you know, here's all the new stuff? Or do you say, hey, you know, here's 10 that really came together? And I don't know. What's your take on that,
man,
Curtis?
My take on it is,
help me out.
I try to make it easy on myself now. If I look at a pile of 15 half written songs, that's a lot of stuff to sort through. And then you get to the recording process. Man, that's just a big mountain to climb. It's going to take some time. It's going to take, you know, your attention is divided in a lot of different directions.
Yeah.
Because you've got this big group of songs. And the way I've been working recently is just having a small batch of songs. When I say small batch, I mean anywhere from 1 to 3.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just working on those at one time, from writing to recording. And then I move on, because I don't like the feeling of being in the studio and we're just mixing the second song or just doing some overdubs on the second song, and we're like, man, we got 8 more to go.
Man, and you do fall into that trap to where you're just running through all 10 of them. Say, man, here's the kick drum, here's the snare.
Man, and
it is difficult.
I kind of, my new philosophy is really work on a song and just make it great, you know, make it well written. Go in, get a great recording of it.
So you'd recommend that for us? Do we focus on a couple of them out of 30?
Absolutely.
You think?
Absolutely. Because, and I say that because
we do that anyway, but it is a tough question. And it's not like, again, it's not so much from an artist perspective that I'm hesitant. It's
you're more filtering for the fans.
Yeah, and I'm just kind of like, man, I just, you know, because, yeah, in the old days, a few years back, you would say, hey, man, let's just add value to the CD, man. We'll put 16 songs on it. We'll put it out there, man, and, you know, we'll do in-stores and stuff. I mean, those days are done.
Those
so you're just kind of like, what do I even put out and when? You know, when is it done? And it's not made for radio. It's not. I mean, we've never been a big radio band or, you know, produced and written songs like, hey, the radio's going to love this. That's really not what we've ever been about. But, you know, and man, I'm excited about the songs themselves and the directions they go, you know, but, you know, I have those old thoughts like, man, maybe I ought to group these 10 that are kind of more acoustic, kind of mellow, and do an album of that kind of stuff, and then keep the more rocking stuff on a record. But I don't know, man. I don't know if that's old thinking. I guess that's the hard thing for me is that I don't know if, like, man, maybe that's just outdated thinking, you know, that
these
songs should be grouped together into some sort of a artistic thing, you know.
To me,
is that dated?
To me, yeah, I think it is. My opinion is it a little dated. And I also approach what I do more like a staff songwriter than a recording artist. If you ask me, what is it that you do? I write songs and try to get people on board with them. And it's one song at a time. And I make it, I really try to take that song and make it memorable.
Yeah.
And push that for a little while, and then a month from now, hopefully I have another really good song that I'm ready to share with everybody. Because that's the way people consume music now anyway.
Yeah.
Is song by song. And if you go to anyone's iTunes page, mine, yours, Tom Petty's, whoever's, you can go and look and see what songs are the most popular.
Yeah, there's no
And man, every artist has a very small handful of songs that gets them their fan base.
Well, you're lucky if you have one or two or three. I mean,
yeah. I mean, I go look at the 40 or so songs that are on my iTunes or whatever, and man, there's like three that are the reason I exist.
Yeah, you know? That's right. Yeah.
And that's not to say that the people who like those three songs don't like the other songs. Man, those other songs, a lot of time and money and effort went into recording them and getting them out there. But if those songs never existed, those three songs would still, people would still like me because of those three songs that are really popular.
Right.
And as an artist, that kind of hurts your ego a little bit. I used to kind of, man, I think that eighth track on River City Blues is genius.
Yeah.
But I'm not always the best person to ask on what is this good or not, you know?
Well, I feel like that on ours. I mean, I feel like even the Bullfighter things, you know, live, a couple of the songs that have really turned into good live numbers, I feel like, or, you know, Find My Own Way off that album. But that was the eighth song. It's the last song on the CD, and sure, people aren't as familiar with it. We'll play that song in a show, and people go, man, is that a new song? You're like, no, man, that was on the last record you bought, you know? And they're like, oh, you know, and it, because you do, you listen to those first few tracks, and you got, guy, Phil's got, you know, 11 other records, and it's hard to keep up with all that. Well, that's some interesting album talk there for Phil Pritchett and the full band. Kurt South's input. Kurt plays every Sunday at Fred's.
Mm-hmm.
That's just the hometown gig, man. It's the best gig in town. Kurt's out there every Sunday. What time do you get going there every Sunday?
Noon to 2. It's the Sunday brunch show.
Dude, this is the in-hip venue thing. Cool burger place. Great food. It is just where all the hungover hip people go and listen to Kurt South every Sunday.
Get there early to get a table. That's the rule.
Early to get a table. That's the rule.
Get a table.
Kurt is there. And hey, if you're a real Phil Pritchett fan out there and you hear Kurt talking me out of releasing like a full album and you're upset about it, you know, go there and just throw some hamburger meat at him. Throw some hamburger meat at him. Or something, you know, and just say, hey, man, thanks for getting Pritchett to release one song at a time. You know, I concur with Kurt's thoughts on that. I like to get input on the, I feel it's not input on my artist stuff, but input on the marketing, the releasing and all that is all fascinating to me. I'm a cottage industry here in Fort Worth, as you all know, fans. We do it all ourselves, so any input I can get, it's much appreciated. Email us as always, phil@philpritchett.com or call me, 817-733-5256. If you're interested in recording at the studio or hearing your topic discussed online, on the next podcast, whatever, please feel free to do that. It's what we do. We do it all for you. We want you to have it all. P2Tunes.com, all the records, $4, and all that kind of good stuff. And more stuff coming down the pike for sure. Really enjoying the writing and playing the new stuff. It'll be out, late spring, I think, we're going to shoot for. And should be able to stay on that course. Now, Kurt's going to stick around for our next segment coming up here. You going to be here?
I'll be here.
We're going to talk about some great-sounding records. This can be new, old, whatever. Mm-hmm. I know I've got my little stack here. I've got my turntable, my vinyl all here at the studio. Always referencing the old great ones when I'm starting to mix, when I'm talking to a new guy in here making a record. Hey man, here's what we're going for, you know, and trying to get their input on it. We'll talk about what really sounds great and why next. Stick around. Welcome back, fans. Lovers of all things music, rock and roll, and especially all things full band. You're listening to the Phil Pritchett Podcast live here, recorded live at Trinidad World Recording, Fort Worth, Texas. This is our second episode. Kurt South is with me, fellow singer-songwriter. We have talked At this part of the show, our final segment here, we talk about records, be that Phil Pritchard albums. Take a closer look, a little perspective on things that maybe you missed, records maybe you don't have, that you may have missed, maybe you haven't listened to enough. You know, here in the studio, I'm always looking for stuff that sounds really great. That's always a very, very difficult thing to put your finger on. Of course, if you've got a great singer and a great song, you can almost record it anywhere. You know, record it in a bathroom on one mic, it's gonna sound pretty good. You know, I mean, you're gonna have something to listen to. But you also have to have great sound, of course. And I think a lot of stuff today, you know, suffers from a homogenous type of production. The firecracker snares and the super punchy kick drums, the blazing guitars, way out front vocals.
Mesa Boogie amplifiers.
Now, there's anything wrong with Mesa Boogies. We're just not a huge fan of the overdriven, I don't know, what would you call it, Mesa Boogie?
Just triple kind of spongy, gain stage. Just
yeah.
Spongy, overly compressed.
Yeah, I'd say that, driven kind of thing with the driveway up. You know, stuff like that. And then an overall just squashed to a lifeless state in mastering stereo compression, et cetera, for radio. We try not to do that here, of course. So, oh, man, records we think sound great. You want to go first on this? You want me to go first?
No, go ahead. Go first.
I've got it in my hand here. It is my copy that I bought for $1 at Half Price Books. It is none other than the third record from our madman across the water himself, Kurt.
Elton John, Sir Elton John.
Yes, Reginald Dwight himself. He put out Tumbleweed Connection. It was his third record, 1970, I believe. 1970, good grief. Before I was even born, this record came out. It's one of those Elton John albums that it doesn't have a lot of hits. You know, it's got, what do you have on here? You've got, God, pull the record out. Burn Down the Mission. Was that the last song? That's the last song, side two. But, man, you got Where To Now, St. Peter, Love Song, Amarina, Talking Old Soldiers. Oh, man, it's just outstanding. If you have never purchased and listened to Tumbleweed Connection by Elton John, you had Bernie Flowers, I believe his name was, great British bass player, played on Space Oddity, David Bowie, all those great bass runs back there. He played bass on this album. Really drives it. It's just the ultimate in British pop rock. It's just got the fattest, bassiest,
yes,
tastiest, you know, analog warm sound, Tumbleweed Connection, maybe of any record I have that I can always revisit and go back and listen to. And the guitar tones in it, you know, just those honky, you know, it's got to be a Vox amp. I'd bet my life on it. Just that honky at the beginning of
Vox with a
Ballad of a Well-Known Gun. The intro into it.
Yeah.
Outstanding stuff. Tumbleweed Connection, Elton John. If you have it, pat yourself on the back and say, come on, Phil. Come on. But let me tell you what, if you're thinking, oh, it's like Elton John was the guy who played in Vegas, you know, and played
the
Super Bowl.
Lion King.
Did the Lion Kings on Oprah. You are right. But let me tell you what, my friends. Like Stevie Wonder and other great artists, Rod Stewart, he had a past life as a visionary, amazing artist, like Jack Black discusses in High Fidelity. Who are they talking about? Stevie Wonder. I just called to say I love you, and he says, can you hold something, you know? Can you hold artists to their, you know, formerly great artists? Can they atone for their post-success sins, you know?
Yeah.
Something like that. Sadly, certainly Elton John would fit right into that somewhere. But
yeah.
Before disco, I'm trying to think, when did Elton John kind of jump the shark to an extent?
Well, the 80s killed all those classic acts in a lot of ways.
Well, I guess when MTV came on, the old dinosaurs will tell you.
Yeah.
You know, it became more about what you looked like and not what you sounded like. They tried to make videos and ended up all embarrassing themselves.
Wearing Windex blue sport coats and yellow skinny ties. And yeah, it kind of went off the rails.
I'm still standing video. You know,
that was brutal.
You know, sort of like Rio. It had to be directed by the same guy that did Duran Duran or something.
There was two directors back then. They did every Boy George and Wham video.
And the lead singer wore all white. And there were women painted like red and blue and stuff running around on the beach.
Just tiger stripes on their face.
Yeah,
just horrible.
And but man, Tumbleweed Connection, man, just a, you know, Elton back in these days was just a confused, oily-faced, adolescent, pudgy, sexually confused guy, that just was searching in his music for some
sounds
kind of
like
reality,
Most of the guys have ever been in my rhythm section. I've played with a bunch of future Elton Johns.
I know. Well, that's who these guys are. Tumbleweed Connection. Get it. All right, Kurt, your turn. Top Tumbleweed Connection. You don't have to top it, but what's something you think sounds good? And give me some little pointers on it.
We touched on this during the break. You mentioned Sweetheart of the Rodeo by the Byrds.
Indeed. And what year was Sweetheart of the Rodeo? I've got it in there. Mid-70s? Was it early 70s?
No, it was early. 70. It was like 71.
Yeah.
Maybe, it might have been 69 even.
Of course, Roger McGuinn, Chris Hillman, Graham Parsons was in then.
You know what? It was probably 68 or 69 because the Flying Burrito Brothers played Altamont Speedway with the Rolling Stones.
Oh, that's right. They were already the post-Birds kind of did, right?
So that album was probably more in the 66 to 68 range. But,
okay.
But that brought up Graham Parsons, and the only two solo albums that Graham Parsons ever released, one of them was self-titled, the other one was called Return.
GP, and then you had
GP and Return of the Grievous Angel.
That's right.
I kind of treat them as one long album because they were reissued as
one CD.
Long
project. I had that one CD, with him sitting in the chair, and the,
Graham Parsons is a lightning rod for a lot of people because he was a complete underachiever while he was alive. He died tragically at the age of 27, as they all the greats do, in a motel room in Joshua Tree, California.
That's right.
Tanked up on just a deadly cocktail of
tequila. Well, the whole legend, of course, of the body. Remember, there was a whole thing.
Yeah, he had made a deal with his manager at the time, one Phil Kaufman, who also formerly worked for the Rolling Stones, a notorious, legendary rock and roll figure on the management end. Just a crazy SOB.
Yeah.
He had made...
The guy always gets paid, though, I bet.
Yes. He asked Phil Kaufman, when he passed away...
Right.
If he would take his body out to Joshua Tree, which is a national park in the deserts of southeastern California.
Right.
And burn his body in the desert.
Yeah, and so like that a funeral pyre kind of Viking burial kind of thing.
Yeah, so that he could just in the desert for eternity.
Right.
Well, Graham Parsons dies...
unexpectedly, of course. Young.
Yeah.
Out of nowhere.
On heroin. Had...
Long
a lot of morphine,
yes.
Tequila, and it's just that was it for him. The plan was originally for his stepdad and his mother lived in New Orleans, and they were to take Graham's body back to New Orleans and bury him.
Right.
And Graham had made it clear that he didn't want to be buried in New Orleans, and nor did he care for his stepfather and all
that.
Of
course, you can't get buried in New Orleans. You're buried above ground.
Yeah, no kidding.
In a crypt, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe he was hip to the whole deal.
He was hip.
He didn't want to go floating out in the ocean with the next
hurricane.
He was ahead
of his time. He didn't want to be just floating in the Gulf of Mexico, just dodging shrimp boats for eternity, So,
man.
So Phil Kaufman goes to the airport and intercepts Graham Parsons' body before it is put on a plane and flown back to New Orleans to be buried in the family.
To carry out his dying wish.
Yes, to carry out his dying wish. And he succeeds in getting Graham Parsons out to Joshua Tree.
But like in a pickup truck? I mean, just in the coffin in the back of the truck?
He drove a hearse anyway.
Oh, really?
He was a freaking nature,
Rhett Miller, old 97s, used to drive a hearse in Dallas.
Really?
Yeah. Little known
sign
story.
Sign of rock and roll greatness.
Sign of rock and roll greatness. Topic for another time. Please continue.
So Kaufman makes good on his promise, and later, some hours after Kaufman has set Graham Parsons' body aflame.
Just him out there?
Yeah.
Just with some gasoline and a match?
He puts a beer and a bottle of booze in his jacket. Just
throws it
Someone reports to the park service, hey, there's a fire in the park. And they go out there, and one thing leads to another. They find out that a body is missing from the airport, and then they find one burning in the desert. So, they figure out it's Graham Parsons, just burning up the night. And Phil, it turns out that stealing a corpse is not illegal, technically.
What?
No, the only thing that
in
they...
In California?
In a lot of states, actually, before it's in the grave.
Huh, okay, yeah,
exhuming
yeah.
a grave without authorization is illegal.
I see.
But there's no law on the books about taking one that's...
So what happened? They let him go?
He got charged with was theft of the casket, which was
not
like
the body.
$600. Yeah, so it was just... He didn't do any jail time or anything. He paid
wow.
a fine.
Wow. Were the remains out there? Or they just
It was just kind of half burned.
Yeah.
And they wound up taking what was left of him, and he wound up in New Orleans anyway, in a shady, shady cemetery off of the airport highway in New Orleans.
Is that where he is now?
Yeah, that's where he is now.
I'll be done.
But the Gram Parsons albums were so many great players on them. You had the great Clarence White.
Emmylou Harris, of course, singing.
You also had Sneaky Pete Kleinow, who died just a couple years ago. Legendary pedal steel player.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a lot's made of the alt-country, country rock stuff, which to me, at a point, it's a bunch of crap. It's like, what is it? It's just another hyphenated subgenre.
Right.
But man, Parsons was kind of the guy. He was a rock and roll hipster. Long hair, dressed in nudie suits, just always coked up and drunk out of his mind, playing traditional country music.
Right.
And he kind of opened the door to that kind of thing. He was the first guy to do that.
So
really.
You feel his records captured the modern? Where do his records kind of fit into that, would you say, sonically?
Man, sonically, they were...
You find them in they still sound great.
Yeah, well, that's where I was coming around that is, if you put those records on today, man, they hold up really well.
Yeah, they do.
And I go back and listen to a lot of stuff that I was really into in my formative years, and the songs are still good, but man, the production sounds like it was made in 1988.
That's right.
You go listen to the first Bodine's album, you can tell it was made in the 80s.
Well, this kind of lends itself to another topic. Maybe we'll discuss on a future show. But there's always a lot of babbling about digital versus analog and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And you can. I think in today's music, it's less defined. Where it gets difficult is, there just seems to be that golden era, man. In the late 60s. 70s until about 75, 76.
Till disco came around,
and you really got more of the keyboards and drum machines and stuff like that. And of course, there's great sounding records made after that.
Sure,
but there was that golden era in there, man.
Where
you do hear that Van Morrison song album cut, you're like, God, what's that on? You know it's on, Tupelo Honey or something. You go back, and it's just right in that wheelhouse. And, of course, me and Kurt read the blog, The Lefsetz Letter, Bob Lefsetz. And, he posed the thought, we love you, Bob. We read all your stuff. You need to subscribe to The Lefsetz Letter. Great stuff. Great thoughts. He did put it in the terms of, that there was a renaissance, from about 1964 to about 1974.
Yeah.
Where, everything happened. It doesn't mean that good stuff hadn't happened since, but just, man, you'll never see the heights again.
Which brings us around to the question, is rock and roll dead? Is it? I mean, it has all been done.
Yeah.
It's all been done.
Has it all been done? Did it die with Gram Parsons out there and Joshua Tree?
I think it died with ABBA.
Yeah. Well, it is tough, when you do hear a new... Oh, even like, Spoon, I'm a big Spoon fan. I really like the way their records sound. I think it's great.
Yeah.
Of course, they're cutting through an old 80 series Neve board, it looks like, on their website, from what I can tell.
I think you overrate them, by the way, but continue.
Yeah, I know. I don't even concur with it as much. I do dig it. Cutting a 2-inch tape on
it. Does sound great.
They got cool sounding stuff. And it does bring that old debate up, what really sounds great. I know you and I love the Jayhawks. But, you know, behind that stuff that sounds great, you do, 9 times out of 10, find the great gear. You know, the old stuff, the tube stuff. It goes without saying. It's no secret that the gear...
It's a short list of gear that produces those sounds.
Yeah.
Whether it be the actual tape machines, the tube and ribbon mics, the great consoles and preamps. Yeah, there's a short list of gear that's responsible for great sound and stuff.
That's
no
right.
Question.
Well, we've got a lot of that here in the studio.
Oh, we do. And, we do. I'm looking at some of that set
just
gear.
Just racks of
just
great gear.
Just creates classic, timeless
sound. The old Telecaster on the wall.
But you know, we mentioned the Jayhawks. You know, they're a band that actively seeks out producers and studios that produce those classic sounds.
Yeah, yeah.
And there aren't a whole lot of those albums still being made by people who are kind of in the mainstream or on big labels now. We mentioned Ray LaMontagne, his album Trouble.
Yeah.
And all of his albums have been produced by Ethan Johns.
Yeah.
Who is a...
Oh, he did all of them? I didn't know he did all of them.
Total subscriber to...
Ethan Johns. Well, he did Rainy Day Music.
Yeah,
Ethan
he did.
Johns as well. The Ben Queller stuff that we all
think sounds
really great.
Done a lot of the Ryan Adams stuff.
Ryan Adams, of course. Yeah.
But, you know, a guy who just records on old, beat-up, but classic gear.
Yeah.
You know, is an analog aficionado. And he goes for those sonic characteristics of classic albums.
That's right.
Which, if you listen to, you know, Tumbleweed Connection, and then you go listen to whatever is on the radio right now, other than that they're both music, they have nothing in common sonically.
Yeah, yeah, there are a lot of big differences. Well, oh man, is that going to wrap up great vinyl talk here today? I don't know if we shed any light. All we said is you need great gear and great songs to make great albums. Is that all we said?
Pretty
Plus
much.
We told the Graham Parsons story. What a great... I never heard the whole details of that. I know his body had been burned.
Ben Fong Torres, who former editor
Rolling
at Rolling Stone,
wrote
this fantastic biography on Graham Parsons.
Oh, is that right?
It's a great read. I highly recommend it.
What's it called?
It is called Hickory Wind.
Oh, okay, yeah.
After the
birds?
Great song.
It's a great bird song, yeah.
Yeah, go read it, man. It'll amaze you at what an absolute screw-up Graham Parsons was. What a junkie... What an arrogant ass he was.
Yeah.
But he was a visionary, and his life story is about as interesting. You couldn't make fiction that was that interesting. So
that's right.
Go
that's
pick it up. Check it out.
We love the rock biographies, man. I read them all, love them all, and I'll add that one to my list. Graham Parsons, rest in peace, we hardly knew ye. This has been Phil and Kurt talking in the vault, Tumbleweed Connection, and talking about the great Graham Parsons records, of course, GP and the Grievous Angel, and how those sounds are still what we're all digging for, man, when we're getting in here in the studio recording. You know, you're throwing those records on, saying, here's what we need to look at, man. Here's what we need to try and go for. Kind of funny that way. Onward it goes. This is Phil Pritchett, and for Kurt South, we're going to be signing off here on episode 2 of the Phil Pritchett Podcast. Email us, phil@philpritchett.com. Let us know your thoughts, comments, questions we can address on the air, what you'd like to see in the show. Tell your friends to subscribe. It's free. It's iTunes. Easy, easy, easy. Of course, you can always download Phil Pritchett and Kurt South songs on iTunes. And Phil Pritchett songs for $4 a piece, or Phil Pritchett albums, $4 a piece at p2tunes.com. Or call the studio, 817-733-5256. We'll see you next time. For now, so long from Trinidad World Recording, Fort Worth, Texas. We'll see you again soon. Take care.